Good morning. So glad you're here on this April Fool's Day. Are we surprised? Not really. Not really. So today I want to talk about, I'm contemplating the rebirth of green life on Earth, the seasonal upwelling of spring, the green energy, which we have to imagine. We can look at the flowers. So in spite of the temperature and the snow, we have confidence, right? We have deep inner confidence that spring is coming. You might say we believe in it. The trees will start to bud. The docks will start to float again. So we'll be able to move more freely. We'll be able to plant gardens again. Engage in celebrations. And so this death of winter will turn into the new life of spring. And we'll turn towards the sun like those little sprouts. So almost all of the various religious traditions celebrate or honor at this time these themes of resurrection or redemption or rebirth, this point on the Gregorian calendar. And in a week, Buddha's birthday is celebrated in Japanese Soto Zen temples all over the world, and in American Soto Zen temples, the birth of awakened heart-mind. So I had the pleasure of attending a Passover Seder on Friday, and I was able to borrow this verse from the service that my friends used for their family. I think it speaks to this moment. Long before the struggle upward begins, there's a tremor in the seed. Self-protection cracks. Roots reach down and grab hold. The seed swells and tender shoots push up toward light. This is Karpas. Spring awakening growth, a force so tough it can break stone. A force so tough it can break stone. Better? Okay. Should I read that one more time? Long before the struggle upward begins, there's a tremor in the seed. Self-protection cracks. Roots reach down and grab hold. The seed swells and tender shoots push up toward light. This is Karpas, spring awakening growth. A force so tough, it can break stone. So I'm using this metaphor today of the force of life that is so tough that it can break stone, to talk about a tough subject, and that is the perilous situation of our planet, the very home we live on, and from. And I'm intending to invite you along with me to contemplate choosing life over death in these times. And I know that sounds like a dualistic concept, but just bear with me. So Joanna Macy, the Buddhist teacher, ecological activist, and change agent, in her work she calls despair work, and this time we're living in, which she calls the Great Turning, she has this to say about the new energy and ecological paradigms that are coming from the different traditions. from Islam comes a resurgence of mystical Sufism with the poetry of Rumi and Kabir, the humorous fables of Nasruddin, and the teachings of contemporary emissaries who offer a devotional response to the essential mystery at the source of our interdependent lives. Within Christianity, a breaking through superstructures of dogma to find the interconnections to our environment in harmony with the latest findings of science, and this isn't new. Nicholas de Sousa, 15th century cardinal and mathematician, perceived God as an infinite circle whose circumference is nowhere and whose center is everywhere. And she goes on, from Judaism too comes a growing number of fresh voices recalling their traditions' ancient reverence for the living body of earth and broadening their call for justice to include all people, all who are still enslaved today or have been hurt by slavery. So at Passover, the phrase Dayenu is voiced in song to invoke the spirit of gratitude and appreciation of enoughness, as in this alone is enough. And a mentor of mine wrote her radical version of a Dayenu verse for her Passover Seder this year. And I brought this to read you some examples from it. When police stop killing black people, Dayenu. When we worry about the promising futures of all youth, Dayenu. When people with mental illness receive compassionate care, Dayenu. When we don't wait for tragedy to strike our school, our town, our family to take action, Dayenu. When every community has clean drinking water, Dayenu. When Islam is no longer branded as dangerous, Dayenu. When we care more about oceans than iPhones, Dayenu. When we learn how to sit together and listen, Dayenu. When the land is returned to itself, Dayenu. When pink and blue no longer represent gender norms, Dayenu. When the clothes on our backs don't come at the expense of human lives, Dayenu. When artists are treasured and elders are honored, Dayenu. So Molly Young Brown, who's taught with Joanna Macy and has written about the Great Turning with her, co-written a book, talks about Buddhism's contributions to this upwelling ecological movement. So I'm just going to read what she says about this, about our tradition. She's a practicing Buddhist. Buddha Dharma especially helps us to understand the new ecological paradigm and work within the healing of the world. The core doctrine of Buddhism, basic to its psychology and ethics, is the dependent co-arising of all phenomena. Arguably the clearest conceptualization of mutual causality prior to general systems theory, and it comes from not only empirical observation and subtle non-linear logic, but also from a resolve to relieve suffering. And she says, meditations such as loving kindness, compassion, equanimity, and joy, and the joy of others, further decondition old patterns of fear and competitiveness and serve as grounding and compass in a fluidly interdependent world. Grounding and compass. In the practice period, the spring practice period, I talked about emptiness and impermanence, and how when we have a strong experience of both emptiness and impermanence, it can be radically unsettling and sometimes scary. And one of the people in the morning group told a story about a woman that he knows who got a diagnosis of cancer, and how she told him that, and that was her radical experience, where the bottom dropped out of the belief systems that she didn't know fully that she had, that were propping her up. And that her experience was that she, after feeling just scared and really uncertain, and she had been a practicing Buddhist herself before this happened, but she said she, with this dropping away, she became extremely empathetic with everyone that she encountered, the people she didn't notice before. And then she began to notice all the other sick people. And, you know, she had a very non-dual experience of what it's like to be interconnected and interpenetrated with other human beings. And then he said after she got better, it went away. And her usual way came back. So grounding and compass. Compassion, equanimity, and joy, and the joy of others as grounding and compass. Pointing the way. I'll read a little more of what she says. Buddha Dharma also provides images for the mind's eye and models for a life of action. The jewel net of Indra, a polycentric vision of reality that presents a total contrast to the hierarchical view. Each being occupying a node in the vast net of everything is a gem whose many facets reflect all the other gems and their reflections too, back and forth infinitely. So you've heard about this jewel net of Indra before? Yeah. Shohaku Okumura used to talk about this quite a bit. The world is interwoven in such a way that each node of its living net contains all mysteries. And there's no need to climb to heaven to find the sacred, when at each spot is Buddha nature, and there the intelligence and compassion at the core of life can ignite entire. As in the hologram of modern science, each part contains the whole. And the Bodhisattva is the one who knows and takes seriously the dependent co-arising of all things. This is why she also knows that there's no private salvation. And that's why she turns back from some ultimate nirvana to re-enter samsara. This is the compassion that blooms naturally when we open to our condition of profound mutuality. So that's pretty good. Don't you think? Pretty good. Understanding of our world view based on the original awakening of Shakyamuni and a Buddhist view of salvation. So in practice period, we've been reading Katagiri Roshi's explanation of how reality functions in the absolute sense, big mind, or the heart mind of awakening, which he calls variously and interchangeably universal life energy, light, emptiness, total dynamic working. Over and over in the book in various ways, using Mahayana teachings, he expresses the way things are in a way that's radically different from the way we were schooled in. And to see ourselves and our world. Life is a continual process, constantly in motion, with no discrete self or actor, just pure action itself, and the dynamic working of emptiness. So all those terms are used synonymously in the book. So I'm thinking about this winter of our lives, of our shared lives that we're in, that we see acted out in the public sphere, and we hear about, and what we see and hear about every day can be pretty overwhelming. I think a rational human response to the chaos that we see all around us is the chaos of injustice and violence toward each other and the earth is anger, isn't it? If we could call anger rational, and grief and sorrow, hopelessness and despair. And despair, if we notice, leads to more violence, which leads to more repression from authorities, which leads to more violence and acting out, or more hopelessness in a cycle. But the worst response to this aspect of our communal life is no response at all, or denial. I think the greatest danger that we face is our own numbness and apathy that we all know about intimately. I do. I know about mine. And sometimes we feel about all these problems that we don't have any control at all. And so we do numb out. We do numb out. And in spite of this, in spite of how chaotic it is in the world, and we know about it, and we hear about it, we don't have to read the paper every day or look on the internet. We'll find out daily about the chaos. There is this so-named great turning or great awakening that's happening at the same time. It's it's happening, and these internet and social media platforms that are as imperfect and prone to manipulation and abuse as they are, have also served as kind of a neural network for us, for information. It's become harder for information to be hidden or suppressed, and oftentimes people in social justice and environmental justice movements, the only way they know about actions is through these platforms. And so in that way, I think there's some hope that just like our brains on meditation, new networks can form in the social realm. There's a sharing of information, and a sharing of information means a sharing of power. So Katagiri Roshi used to say that day-to-day life is an emergency case. I think if we deny that, it's at our own peril. Because even though it's true for some of us, and maybe most of us in this room, that our own lives are fairly prosperous and peaceful, we know by just paying attention that that's not true for everyone. And, It's really true, that story from the Lotus Sutra about the father who has to lure his children out of the burning house with toys. I think it was a cart. I have this cart out here for you with a goat to pull it. And they were... They didn't want to leave the burning house. And that speaks to an aspect of our psyche that's like the children's in the story. We often can't bear to look too closely at the burning house of our environmental and societal houses. So we ignore it and we focus on our small spheres and our individual happiness. And since Katagiri said those words 30 or more years ago, the reality of them is really fresh for me. I look at the contrast between my peaceful life and that of so many others in my city and in my country and in this and globally. So in our current emergency case, there's also this opportunity to wake up, to live with intention, with compassion and wisdom together while walking through the emergency together. We all know what happens when there's a natural disaster. Everybody helps, reaches out and helps everyone else. So that's really something we can do in this emergency case that I'm talking about. The danger lies in apatheia or apathy, the inability to see clearly and respond due to overwhelm. And we're all just prone to this overwhelm. So we really need to help each other stay awake and aware in the midst of all this, aware of more than what's in our little sphere. So this is what I've been thinking about, and I want to share some ideas about what we could do together, what we could practice together to deal with the situation. What I always found comforting when I first learned about Buddhism was actually the First Noble Truth, that life is characterized by dukkha or suffering. And the reason I found that comforting is because I suffered. And all the explanations and consolations that had been given me in my childhood faith and in my family were cold comfort. So actually it was oddly comforting to find out that there was a teaching and a faith that just states it right out of the gate. So, number one, clearly seeing our current reality, our current reality, and the current reality of our world, and seeing our individual abilities and intentions, we can create a goal with a realistic assessment of ourselves and our capacities, limitations, and needs. We don't have to leave ourselves out. Absolutely not. So I'll tell you my one small action for this year around this, was and continues to be, that I've made a commitment to an organization called Tree Sisters, because I love trees, and trees are a potent symbol for me of strength, stability, and beingness. And so I give a small donation every month towards reforestation of the Amazon rainforest. And there are benefits. You know, there's a community of women who communicate and do practices that help us get in touch with the energy of the earth, the living, breathing energy of the earth. So that's my one small thing. So two, We can practice with transforming afflictive emotions. You hear about that a lot here at Zen Center. We can sit with them. We can own them. So if I'm feeling some anger, then I sit down with it and become intimate with it and own it and care for it. That's a practice that I do when I feel angry. 3, we can use our wounds to connect to others and to a work or common cause that's greater than our individual happiness or pleasure. So that could be small, like being part of Zen Center, for instance, or other groups where you can do service, or it can be big, you know, connecting with a large movement. Gandhi, an example of a big movement is Gandhi's work in India. And I've read about him that he was not a perfect person. He was troubled. He had some serious psychological issues. But instead of putting the focus on himself healing the issues that way, he put his focus on working in the world. He put his wounds into the service of something larger. So 4, we can cultivate, along with focused attention and insight, compassion and loving kindness as serious tools for developing altruistic happiness and the ability to be in or quickly recover quiet joy under all kinds of circumstances. We can do it. We can do that. Something we can do. 5, we can allow the full range of feelings, whether it's grief, despair, hopelessness, despondency, those feelings, we can allow them in, and they're natural under the circumstances. We can let go of embarrassment and share these feelings with others. We can be strong enough to be vulnerable. And so I'll tell you a story about that. In 2001, I went to San Francisco in Green Gulch, and I was going to a retreat at Green Gulch, and I stopped to spend the night at San Francisco, and I'd never been there before. So that was meaningful to me, you know. It was like the going to visit the big mothership of, you know, American sort of Zen. And I got there, they were in the very end of a Antaiji style sesshin, which is a very intense 50-minute sits, and I don't believe they do a work period. They don't do any services, so it's quite intense. So I came into the energy of that, and it was heavy. It was heavy energy. It was so heavy. And after one day, it was over. And then, you know, you could talk to people and they could talk to you, but nobody talked to me. So I had the most intense experience of loneliness that I can remember in my adult life. Just powerful loneliness. So I called my sister-in-law who lives in Marin and told her that. And that helped. And then I got a ride to Green Gulch the next day. And it was the Sunday service. And Tenshin Reb Anderson was giving the talk. And during his talk, he said, if you're feeling lonely, tell someone. If you're feeling lonely, tell someone. It was one of those moments where you feel like they're reading your mind, you know. So after the service at the tea, I did that. I approached a nice-looking young couple, and I introduced myself and told them where I was from, and then I told them I was really, really lonely. And they were really nice. They were like, oh, okay. And it was a great experience that I remember. And so now I'm going to challenge you at the tea today, after this talk, and after the announcements, I just want to invite you, maybe not challenge, just invite you to, instead of saying, oh, how are you? I'm fine. Just get in touch with a true feeling and whatever it is, and just introduce yourself. Just share that. Just try that. See what that's like. Number 6, we can connect to the energy of earth, animals, and trees intimately. Appreciate what we have now. The abundance. See the beauty every day. Cultivate gratitude for the generosity of our planetary home. I gave an exercise for doing this in the practice period, and someone in the morning group described doing it, going to stand in the morning after his meditation under a tree and feeling foolish at first and like nothing was happening, and then staying with it and noticing that when the wind blew, the branches of the tree and the branches of the tree moved, that it was like one complete happening, and it included him. He also saw the sun come up, the sunrise, and the changes in the sky, all the minute changes, and he realized afterwards how quickly the whole thing played out, how quickly it went from one shade of color to the next to full light of day. So we don't have to just worry. We should really appreciate the beauty and be in nature intimately. So 6, I don't know if I'm getting this quote correctly. This is from Suzuki Roshi. Do small things. I mean, this is 7. Do small things daily with great care forever. Is that it, Rosemary?
Make your best effort every moment.
Okay. I think that's more accurate. So we can do this, right? We can do this. That's our practice. Because the way we do what we do is what creates those pathways of habit. We can practice planting seeds in the desert, which is a quote from the light that shines through infinity. Or we could think of it as planting seeds right now in the ice of future happiness, our own happiness, based on being awake and aware of kindness in the world. We can practice meaningful conversations in multiple community settings or sanghas, speaking from the heart, learning and teaching each other, being honest, accessing more feelings. We have such a limited vocabulary of feelings. We can expand that. We can expand that vocabulary. So I've been listening to some talks by the French-born and educated Tibetan monk, teacher, Matthew Ricard. And really enjoying him. His French accent is fairly... How would you describe a strong French accent? Yes. And so listening to him is a little bit like listening to Katagiri or Suzuki Roshi, except instead of a Japanese accent, it's French. And at first I thought, maybe I should just read his books, you know, because it was actually kind of hard to get into it. But I stuck with it and have really been enjoying it. He's been called the happiest man in the world, which he disputes. I mean, he basically says that's media hype. But the reason behind that is because he's done 40,000, he estimates 40,000 hours of meditation, including the practice of loving kindness and compassion. And they scanned his brain, Richie Davidson at the University of Madison, Wisconsin, in his studies, he was a subject. He thought it would be fun. And out of that came this label as the happiest man in the world. So the areas lit up in the scan were larger than other areas of the brain. And there are areas correlated with compassion and altruism. And he became famous after that. So he came out of his years of secluded meditation, working closely with teachers like the Dalai Lama and Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. He was a personal attendant for Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche and spent lots of hours with him, absorbing that light and that compassion and kindness. And so he made over $1 million on his books and his talks, which he used to start a charity, an organization, a relief organization that benefits children, particularly girls. And so his big thing, his big teaching for us is that that's where the joy is. That's where the happiness is. It's putting, it's based on practice. It's based on cultivating awareness and kindness and magnanimity, as Katagiri says. So I really appreciate his teaching. And basically he says that loving kindness, or another translation of metta, is boundless friendliness. And I think that is a little more accurate. We don't feel loving towards everyone, but we can expand our sense of friendliness. Include more people in that. So now I think we're getting close to the end of our time, and I hope that you will practice having a meaningful conversation at tea. Hey, you check in with yourself right now and feel what you're feeling. notice what emotions might be there. And that you'll practice being vulnerable. I could teach you a song if you really begged me to.
Please.
I was concerned there might not be enough voices here for a song. We have to have enough voices. So I'll take that to be begging. And I'll generously assent to your wishes. So the song is was written by Lawrence Cole, who's a song leader out in on Bainbridge Island in Washington State, and he adapted it from this piece by Oriah Mountain Dreamer called "The Invitation." So. You're going to learn this with me, and we'll do it call and response, and then we're going to split into two parts, and this side of the room is going to sing the first part and keep singing it. So if you see me doing this, it means just keep going. That's what that means, okay? And then this side of the room, including all of you back there, will start to sing. Okay, and then you'll keep going, and they'll keep going, and eventually I'll say, I'll do this, and then you can stop, okay? So first we have to learn it, and it's very short, and it's called "Let Us See the Beauty." So I'm going to sing, and you'll sing back to me all together, okay? Please do. Or at least hum. So it goes like this. I want to know if you can see the beauty, even when it's not pretty every day. I want to know if you can see the beauty, even when it's not pretty every day. Second line, I want to know if you can see the beauty and source your life from its presence. I want to know if you can see the beauty and source your life from its presence. Let's try that one again. It's got some pauses that are different.
What's the verb in the second part of that sentence? I'm missing the source.
And source. We'll do it again, okay? That one. I want to know if you can see the beauty and source your life from its presence. Okay, and the last part is... Can you see the beauty every day? Can you see the beauty every day? Do you feel ready to put all these few lines together? Let's do it all together. We won't do an around, okay? I want to know if you can see the beauty, even when it's not pretty every day. I want to know if you can see the beauty and source your life from its presence. Can you see the beauty every day? Let's do that one more time together. Then we'll just try two parts. This is good for your brain cells. I want to know if you can see the beauty, even when it's not pretty. pretty every day. I want to know if you can see the beauty and source your life from its presence. Can you see the beauty every day? See, now you know it. So, let's start with this side, and then they'll come in, and you just keep going and do it again and again, and I'll help you. And then they come in, and then we'll, and then I'll stop us, okay? So we'll just try it. Okay, this side. I want to know if you can see the beauty, even though it's not pretty every day. I want to know if you can see the beauty. I think we'll just sing it together one more time. That'll be it. I realize unless I can clone myself here, it's not possible. Yeah, you're doing the whole part. You're doing it all. Let's just sing it one more time, and then that's it. I want to know if you can see the beauty, even when it's not pretty every day. I want to know if you can see the beauty and source your life from its presence. Can you see the beauty every day? Okay, that's good. Really good. Thank you. Thank you for begging me to teach you. Okay, so we don't really have a lot of time for discussion. Maybe just a couple comments. Stephen.
You know, apropos of your introduction, mm-hmm. you know, and because it is Easter, 2,000 years ago, in what was then Judea, Samaria, there was a great deal of uncertainty, a great deal of speculation that it was end times. And because of that, perhaps, and certainly in the midst of it, the preaching of this itinerant guy from Nazareth kind of took hold, and for better or for worse, who knows, but it was transformative. And I think what's less well known maybe for our tradition is that 1,200 years later, the same kind of thing was going
yes.
on in Japan. It was a terrible time in Japan at the end of the 12th century and the early 13th century. A huge amount of concern about the future of their society. And in response to that, this guy Dogen, you know, kind of transforms them into the tradition that we are sitting here as a part of today, over 800 years later. So I think it's real easy to get caught up in despair. But when you have historical precedents like this, you know, I've always loved the saying that in the muddy water, the lotus blooms. And,
mm-hmm.
and here are two very important iterations on religious traditions that at least grew up in the midst of this, arguably in response to it at other times. So who knows? I think staying focused on what we can do makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, thanks. And we should feel our feelings, whatever they are.
As you were talking, very similar to the thoughts you were having. I was also thinking of, you know, I have three young adults at home. I have a 21-year-old and a 17-year-old. And my 21-year-old was talking about, you know, it's so tough. It's very despairing. And I was able to share with her some of the current Dalai Lama's thoughts on that. Because he was asked the same thing. Don't you feel a lot of despair? No, I just look to see where humanity has been.
Ah, good,
where
yeah.
Where we've grown to now.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to hear her? She was talking about her son feeling. What was he feeling?
It was my daughter. And she
Your
was
daughter.
Feeling a lot of despair in the current.
Feeling
climate.
Despair.
And Dalai Lama's response to that very same question was, look where humanity has come, and he has so much hope just because he's seen the progression of human, or, you know, reflecting on the progression of humanity.
Right. So, was that helpful for her?
Yes.
Good.
And it was helpful for me to think on that as well.
Yeah. Great, thanks. Anybody else?
I was talking with Susan the other day, and she was playing and talking about, even though there's so much awful stuff happening right now, that there's this other thing happening. You know, with the kids with the gun control and Black Lives Matter and women speaking up for themselves. And so there's ways that something else is arising from the muddy water that is wonderful.
Yep. Okay. So, thanks again. Thank you, Tim. I wouldn't be able to sit up here if it weren't for you.